Welcome to Connection, the program that connects people to people. Today on Connection, you'll hear from two people confronting society's prisons. One confronts the prison of religious prejudice in Northern Ireland, another confronts the prisons of the American correctional system.
I never walk in a prison door and a gate that I don't feel depressed for the people who are there.
You'll hear these stories and more today on Connection. Connection. Oscar Wilde, the Irish author, once wrote, "The vilest deeds, like poison weeds, bloom well in prison air. It is only the good in man that wastes and withers there." Now, I don't know whether or not Parker Evatt of Columbia, South Carolina, ever heard those words, but he certainly would agree with them. Although Parker is now director of the Austin Wilkes Society, a society named for and following the direction of a United Methodist clergyman concerned about prisoners, his life was not always so focused.
I got involved because I was active in the Christian social concerns of my church here in Columbia. And my pastor one day sent me a little notice of a meeting about the Austin Wilkes Society and said, "You ought to go, it's a good organization." This was about 13 years ago. I did go, and there was 30 or 40 people there, and that was my introduction to the Austin Wilkes Society, and I became a volunteer talking about the work of the society, and any church or any group would listen to me trying to get members and support for the organization because we were trying to save enough money so we could hire the first employee. And about a year and a half later, a clergyman here, a Baptist clergyman, asked me would I like to become the first executive director, and personally I laughed at him. I said, "You've got to be kidding. I'm an engineer. I have been for 10 years and trained. The only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life." And he kept talking to me, and the challenge was laid before me. And I guess after a month and a half of prayerful consideration, I chose to leave my field and getting this new endeavor. And it's something I've never regretted. It's something I've enjoyed. And I think that as long as I live, I'll probably be involved in this type of work.
Parker's life, his vocation, was dramatically turned around. But Parker has found that many, many people, in helping him in his new job, have turned their lives and the lives of others around. Not quite as suddenly, perhaps, but just as dramatically.
Stepping in, not knowing what I was doing, was frightening at first. It took a lot of support of people because I'd never tried to get a person a job. Very seldom did I ever get a job myself. Most of them have been offered to me. When I got out of college, I had three offers of a job. I didn't apply for them. And I know that almost all my whole life, people have asked me to get involved. And here I was asking people to hire somebody getting out of prison. And that was, not an easy task. But once you saw the response of people around the state, it was very easy. Because there are a lot of people out there who care about, fellow human beings. And if I look back over the 12 years I've been involved, I can say that the volunteers, sure, there are many, many case histories I could tell over and over of successful people, but when I think about some of the volunteers who've been involved, who cared about their fellow man, it's just so rewarding, it's just hard to explain.
With every note I play with love. With every word I sing, it's coming from my heart. And so I sing a song of joy for you. With all the happiness this melody brings. With all the happiness this melody brings. Seems you always had a prayer for me when no one cared for me. You were so kind to me. And so I sing a song of joy for you. With all the happiness this melody brings. With all the happiness this melody brings.
You're listening to Connection. Parker Evett's life changed dramatically because of his Christian faith. Feeling that a person doesn't have to go into Christian social work to express their faith, Parker organized a workshop in his church so that others could tell about their vocation and their faith.
I think every vocation is a Christian vocation. Whether you're a doctor, a dentist, or a mechanic, or a housewife, if you're a Christian involved in that, that's a Christian vocation. And it was really exciting to see these people come in and tell how they felt like that Christ was an important part of their life, and they're meeting with the public, and they're meeting with their fellow and colleagues, or closing a deal, or working on a car, that Christ was part of their life, and every time they had the opportunity to meet someone, that they tried to display this. And that's my feeling in my work.
Part of Parker's work is educating people about the needs of prisoners, to put faces on the statistics of our correctional system. For this purpose, Parker ran for and was elected to the South Carolina General Assembly.
In the last 2 years, I've carried 52 legislators through our maximum prison. Out of those 52, 46, that's the first time they'd ever been in a prison in their life. And just look at the face when we walk in an old prison cell where it's not really a decent place to live, and people are caged up like animals. I have that same feeling that I had 12 and 13 years ago when I went into prison for the first time, that prison is not good for anybody. And when I see a smile on a person's face in a prison, and I know that maybe it was because something I done or my agency done, it makes me feel good, because I don't see many smiling people in prison. And when you can be a ray of sunshine or a hope for someone to know that someone out there cares, someone knows they aren't forgotten forever, then it gives me a feeling of satisfaction. But I never walk in a prison door and a gate that I don't feel depressed for the people who are there. Everybody we usually work with has been a failure. And if we can salvage a failure, we've done something. And that's the only thing that would keep me going in that, is that we try to salvage the failures of the community, where the church has failed, the families fail, the educational systems fail, and they end up in prison and say, "Hey, prison, we want you to cure this person. We want you to take care of where all of us have failed. We know you have the expertise to do it." Well, no prison has that expertise. It's going to take a love and concern of someone to be able to break that cycle of going to prison.
You'll hear more from Parker Evett after this song. This is Connection.
It's a lesson too late for the learning, made of sand, made of sand. In the wink of an eye, my soul is turning. In your hand, in your hand. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better, didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. As we walk on, my thoughts keep a tumbling round and round, round and round. Underneath our feet, the subway rumbling. Underground, underground. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better, didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. Mm-hmm.
You got reasons aplenty for going. This I know, this I know. For the weeds have been steadily growing. Please don't go, please don't go. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better, didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? I could have loved you better, didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind.
You're listening to Connection and Parker Evett, director of the Austin Wilkes Society, a program successful in the rehabilitation of prisoners because of the dedication of Christian volunteers. Parker recalls one success, a success made possible because people were willing to give of themselves.
When I think of a young black man from Charleston, South Carolina, who came to our program about 8 or 9 years ago, and he didn't have anything in his pockets. He had 25 cents. And to think that 4 years and 4 months later, he's a college graduate, married to a graduate student in education, and going on and opening two businesses for his other colleagues in Charleston, near the place where he grew up in the ghettos. That's exciting to me. When I see that man walk across the street and dressed in a nice suit and a big smile on his face, and he stands 6'3" and 225 pounds, but he's so meek and humble and so successful. And to know that he's a taxpayer instead of a tax burden, and to know that there are just so many like him that are making it out in the free world because someone stopped long enough along the way and give him a hand of friendship, a pat on the back, and a loving care. And three or four volunteers got involved in that guy's life the day he got out of prison. And when he sat there, his mother sat there with him when he got his diploma at the University of South Carolina. Those four volunteers were sitting beside her. And I know if he was here today, he'd say, that's the reason I'm here. Four people give me 4 years and 4 months of their life. And when they say prison rehabilitation doesn't work, I say it's never been tried in the United States. It's never been tried. We talk about programs, but they've never been properly funded. We've never put the expertise. If we can send a man to the moon and bring him back and drop him in eyesight of a ship, we ought to be able to solve the social problems such as that they're dealing with a budging prison population.
Is there something that we as Christians can do? Is there something unique that you as a Christian have to offer a prisoner? People do things for different reasons. What's yours? Well, you'll have to decide that for yourself. But regardless of your motivation, the first step is to get involved.
There are two reasons I think you should get involved in our work, and we've got a place for you. We've got a place for you if you want to deal with a child, a status offender who had never went to prison, who's a runaway, a truant. And a runaway is a little girl whose mother and father died in a serious automobile accident, and she went to live with an uncle, and after being there a week, he made sexual advances toward her, and she ran. She had a runaway, and they put her in an industrial school for 2 years. We think there ought to be a better place than that, and we have emergency parents. And you could be emergency parents. You and your wife could take a child in one night or two nights. Instead of them spending a night in jail, they could spend a night in your home. Or a woman who is at our woman prison who hasn't received a visitor, or a man in our maximum prison that would just like someone to talk to on a Saturday or Sunday twice a month. Only takes 2 hours a month to get involved in just saying, hey, someone out here knows you're alive. We want to get involved. Or at one of our halfway houses where we have men trying to make it, and some are trying to to get a high school diploma while they're there. And if a person could just come by one night a week and tutor them for about an hour.
If you're interested in helping Parker Evett with the work of the Austin Wilkes Society in Columbia, South Carolina, or if you're interested in starting something like his program in your community, write us at Connection, Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202, and we'll put you in touch with Parker. I'll give you our address again at the end of the program.
Connection!
Last week on Connection, we heard Mrs. Barbara Gallagher read one of the poems from her book Embers, a collection of 40 verse meditations on the tragedy of the daily conflict in her native Belfast, Northern Ireland. Her plea for peace and Christian unity was captured in the poem about the random killings of two of her relatives. Today we hear from her husband, the Reverend Dr. Eric Gallagher, former head of the Methodist Church in Ireland, long involved in the struggle for peace and reconciliation. In addition to his efforts at reconciliation through national leadership, he has on many occasions become personally involved. He tells us about one of his early encounters.
In August 1969, violence erupted not only in the northwest of the province, but very particularly in Belfast. Many people were driven from their homes, and I had been engaged along with others in trying to do something to cool the temperature. And then with the eviction of people from their homes, my own particular headquarters building was used as a refugee center. And on the morning after the first night of heavy violence, while I was working with the refugees, I received a message from the official Unionist headquarters, that is the headquarters building of the Unionist Party, which was the dominant party in Northern Ireland at that time, indicating that the General Secretary of the party wanted to see me urgently. I went in to his office, which actually was in the same street as my own building, and he had a group of shop stewards, trade unionists from the shipyard, the biggest employment agency in Belfast. And the purpose of the request was to meet these trade unionists, and they indicated that feelings were running very high in the shipyard. They were proposing to hold a mass meeting of 14,000 men that day, and they were most anxious that I should address that meeting and seek to influence the men in peacekeeping activities. I was very reluctant to do it, but they said the time had come for people to stand up and be counted, and I ought to be willing to face the challenge. And so with considerable trepidation, I went to this big meeting. It was the first thing of that kind that I had ever had to do in my life, and I found it a very daunting and challenging experience. I had over the years probably said things and done things which did not endear me to many on the loyalist side. I had made it clear that I felt that we ought to be seeking for reconciliation with our Catholic fellow countrymen, and that while we had our own Protestant principles to adhere to, they did not prevent us from seeking reconciliation and some kind of living together in harmony. And when the meeting started, a group of these loyalists paraded right down into the center of the meeting, and I felt that the meeting was certainly going to turn out as a fiasco. But in the providence of God, I can't remember now what I said, but at one point along the line, the crowd began cheering. And then one of the shop stewards, to my amazement, came and he said, "Look, all the shop stewards want you to finish this meeting with prayer." And I reckon it's the first time any shipyard meeting in Belfast ever finished with prayer. And I'm told that tears were coursing down the cheeks of the men there. And somehow that meeting had a trauma and a traumatic effect on me, which drove me into deeper and deeper into this kind of field of activity. My motivation basically is my conviction that all men and women are children of God. And as children of God, we've got to love each other. We've got to work with each other. There is no future in this world unless people find the way of coexistence. It's as simple as that.
The Reverend Dr. Eric Gallagher of Belfast, Northern Ireland. This is Connection.
It's gonna take some time this time to get myself
and shape. I really fell out of line this time. I really missed the gate. The birds on the telephone line
next time
are crying out to me
next time.
And I won't be so blind next time, and I'll find some harmony.
But it's going to take some time this time,
and I can't make demands.
But like the young trees in the winter time,
I'll learn how to bend. After all the tears we spent, how could we make amends? So it's one more round for experience, and I'm on the road again. And it's going this time, and I can't make demands. I learn how to bend.
But like the young trees in the winter time,
I'll learn how to bend. After all the tears we've spent, how could we make amends? So it's one more round for experience, and I'm on the road again. And it's going to take some.
The agonizing toil of the cotton field seems to have a way of consuming entire thought lives, of sucking out slowly the juices of the soul. Today was no different, but for now the blistering heat has stopped. The cool evening breeze is gently giving relief to her tired, aching body. And though she's only 9 years of age, she's done her share for the day, picking 250 pounds of cotton. Mary McLeod Bethune is the last of 17 children and the first free child in her family. Her parents, her brothers, and her sisters had all been slaves on the McLeod plantation until the end of the Civil War. Although there's seemingly no possible way in sight, the thriving passion within her young heart tonight, as it has been every other night, is to be able to read and write. Mary's dream began to be realized when a free school was opened 5 miles from her home. Kicking up stones and bending branches, she beat her path along those grassy hills, walking it back and forth for some 10 years. Then she was granted a scholarship provided by a dressmaker in Denver, Colorado, to attend Scotia Seminary. Upon graduation, her desire was to go to Africa as a missionary. But God refused her Africa.
There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead.
In the little Methodist church where she'd learned to love him, she had also learned the sound of his no. But by saying no to those dreams, God was able to make her a missionary to people of all races here in America. after marrying Albert Bethune, she opened up her own school. This was done on a capital of exactly $1.50. Five girls showed up for the first class session on October 3rd, 1904. But the private little school that had started on less than a shoestring became Bethune-Cookman College of Daytona Beach, Florida. During the years that Mrs. Bethune served as president, the school gained international recognition. Many leave legacies to their nation, money, land, libraries, and the like. But the last will and testament of Mary McLeod Bethune, penned just before her death in 1955, included a collection of priceless gifts to all of us.
I leave you love, I leave you hope, I leave you the challenge of developing confidence in each other. I leave you a radical dignity. I leave you a desire to live harmoniously with your fellow man.
In 1974, Mary McLeod Bethune returned to Washington in the form of an 18-foot statue. It is the Capitol's first statue on public ground to honor either a black person or a woman.
The dramatization you heard today is part of a series on the history of Methodism. These are drawn from a book entitled Endless Line of Splendor. By special arrangement, a complimentary copy of Endless Line of Splendor is being made available to listeners of Connection simply by writing to us. Endless Line of Splendor is a collection of the inspirational stories of Methodists living lives of faith. Stories of faith in action stretching from John Wesley to Senator Daniel Inouye, from England to America, and to the farthest reaches of the Methodist missionaries. For your complimentary copy of Endless Line of Splendor, write to us at Connection, Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202. That's Connection, Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202, for your complimentary copy of Endless Line of Splendor. Connection is brought to you each week at this time by the United Methodist Churches in your area. I'm Bill Richards.